Diamond K Talk YA now presents The Young Queens and the Oracle Queen from the Three Dark Crowns series by Kendar Blake.
Welcome back to M&K Talk YA.
I'm Marissa Snyder.
And I'm Katie Bradford.
And this is our young adult fiction podcast. And this week, we read two novellas in the Three Dark Crowns quadrilogy. These are like two short stories that go with a series. And they are called The Young Queens and The Oracle Queen. And we read them both.
Yeah. And they were kind of exactly what I think I wanted, actually.
Really?
In terms of novellas. Like, I love that we got a peek into the girls growing up, and then I love that we got, like, another historical queen. Not that the stories were everything I wanted necessarily, but I think those were two good choices for novellas to build out the world and to flesh out some of the characters.
I agree with you, and I really liked The Oracle Queen. I think that was my favorite out of the two. The Young Queens, it was like, not enough for me.
What did you want in addition? Or what was missing?
I guess I just wanted, like, a little bit more in-depth with them living together. Because they were, like, separated very quickly and mm-hmm. went to live with their own respective homes. And then it was just, like, we see little flashes of Jules and, like, Jules meeting Camden. That was, like, a two-sentence thing. And we only see, like, the aftermath of Joseph trying to escape with Arsinoe. Like, I wanted a little bit more there.
Yeah, it was quick, and it did a lot of things at once. But I thought it was interesting because it actually answered a few of our questions. So,
do you want to start with that one?
Yeah, let's start with that one.
Let's start with the Young Queens.
So, a couple of things that I remember reading about that I thought was cool was we got a little bit more about Madrigal and Kara's relationship, and when the mom left and came back, and Kara's relationship with Joseph's brother, whose name I forgot, Matthew, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we also found out that Joseph's family is, like, giftless, which I thought was good that we finally heard that.
And Joseph has, like, a very weak sight gift. Because remember, we kept being like, why does Joseph not have a familiar? Like, this is so weird.
And I couldn't even tell if he actually had a sight gift or if he just was convinced he had a sight gift and everyone, like, humored him. But yeah, I thought that was kind of funny. And then I guess I agree. It was, like, really brief and quick, and it didn't necessarily unveil any mysteries or anything, but I felt like it did give a little bit more character to things. Like, even the fact that, so we see the three sisters were friends. We didn't get a lot about what that friendship was, but we saw them, like, clinging together before they were mm-hmm. separated into their three families. And seeing them each kind of start to forget the others, and the fact that was, like, a normal process, but Mirabella resisted so hard, and that's why she, in the books that series that we're reading, she was the one who remembered most them growing up, but even she was starting to forget. And I kind of liked how they played on that, and they were still true to everything we knew about the characters, but it was also interesting, Catherine, so we did find out that they were switched. It wasn't that she just lied about Arsinoe being a poisoner, but Catherine was also a naturalist.
She's a naturalist, yeah.
Catherine's a naturalist. So I thought that was interesting, but I still had a lot of questions, to your point. It was, like, kind of a teaser, and we got glimpses of stuff, and we got some background for things, if anything, more the side characters than anything else, maybe, but there's a lot more that she could have done.
Yeah, I think my favorite part of this book was seeing Madrigal and Kara, because I totally forgot that Madrigal left after Jules was born.
I didn't realize it was that soon. I knew she was gone for a bit, but I didn't realize, like, what critical years it was.
Right, and that totally explains why, like, Jules has such a good bond with Kara. Mm-hmm. And I liked that we get the background about the curse that the sisters have, like, all the Malone sisters.
I had so many questions about that still.
Yeah.
But yes.
So, mm-hmm. like, two girls are born in each generation. One is barren.
Mm-hmm.
And Madrigal already had Jules, so Kara thinks that, you know, if the curse manifested in her, that she's not going to have kids. And that's why she was so close to Jules. Like, when Madrigal left, she really considered mm-hmm. Jules her daughter. Like, she practically raised her, which she did mm-hmm. raise her when she was
Yeah,
she
for
left.
Multiple reasons. Right. Yeah, knowing she couldn't have her own, or thinking she wouldn't be able to have her own kids, and the fact that she was the only mother figure for Jules at that time.
Right. And so then when Madrigal returned and, like, reclaimed her as her daughter, yeah, you can see how that would be, like, gut-wrenching.
Yeah. Although, it was also interesting because, so, is that why they thought Madrigal was going to have a second daughter and were so shocked she had a son?
Yeah, I think so.
And I wonder what the curse means for Jules. Yeah.
Right. And, yeah, is Madrigal going to have another daughter?
Well, she can't because she died, right?
Oh, the god, that's right. I always forget that.
But also, who knows what she did on the mainland for all those years? Maybe she does have another daughter. Yeah, that's who true. Knows?
Yeah, I want to know, like, why Madrigal left. What did she do when she was gone? Mm-hmm. I still want to know who Jules' father is. We still didn't learn that.
Yeah, and we still didn't get a ton of back. So we saw Madrigal and Kara when she returns, but we didn't really get enough of their relationship even beforehand. So we got a little bit more information about it, but I still feel like there's a lot there that it wasn't clear where it started from or how it came about.
Yeah.
Like, if they were closer before or not, or, you know, where some of the competitive-ishness came from or whatever. And to your point, why did Madrigal leave, and what was she doing while she was gone?
And how? Because you can't, like, you can't leave the island unless it's the will of the goddess, they always say. So, like, Madrigal seems to come and go as she pleases, so...
But it might be the goddess doesn't care about her. Like, I feel like the goddess cares about the queens, which is why it's so hard for them to leave or whatever. But I don't know. But yeah, I mean, to your point, yeah, that's still... It's still a question.
And how awful that, like, as soon as Madrigal comes back, the first thing she does is, like, tell Arsinoe that she's going to be killed if she doesn't become queen. Like, ugh.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear them all learn that. So I guess they didn't grow up knowing that they were going to kill each other. And they were waiting for them to, like, forget about each other, which was also really interesting. So they, like, knew they had sisters, but they, like, start to forget the true relationship behind it. And even watching Catherine at the beginning when she starts to be tested on her poison. I don't know. I felt like, again, it was really quick flashes. And for 100 pages, I don't know how much more you could have done unless you just picked one of those time periods and stayed there. But I feel like it was a fun glimpse into their background. Again, it was mostly true to everything and answered a few little side questions, but it didn't really reveal anything huge either.
True.
It's kind of how I felt.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I did enjoy reading it, but I also had questions too. Like, why do they forget their sisters? Is that some kind of magic that happens? Because even, like, Camille, their mother, mentioned that, like, when she leaves the island, she forgets all about her triplets.
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, how does that work? Is that part of, like, the mist does that? Or it's just, like, the whole idea of, like, forgetting. I can understand maybe if you're, like, a 5-year-old and you might forget. But, like, I don't understand how a queen can forget that she had triplets.
Yeah. Well, the other part I kind of liked, too, was how Luca got introduced to the whole thing and how she got pulled into Mirabella's piece. So, again, we kind of knew some of the story. We knew that Mirabella had been throwing tantrums. We knew that Luca sided with Mirabella. But I didn't know, like, Mirabella had been locked in the basement for years.
I know. And they, like, knock her unconscious because they can't control her. And she's, like, flipping out and causing storms.
Well, terrible. Even that, it didn't seem like, what's her name, was her friend back then.
Sarah.
Yeah. I thought that we were going to see her be, like, an ally when the parents were locking her up, but we didn't really see that either. She wasn't necessarily a bad guy, but she wasn't necessarily an ally.
Right.
I don't know. For 100 pages, it was fun, but I agree. There's still a lot of questions and a lot more I'd love to see.
I think I felt the worst for Catherine just because we've seen her only as an adult, like, very hardened and kind of, like, almost cruel.
She wasn't even like that in the first book. That was after she fell into the domain and got possessed by the queens. But yes.
And, like, seeing her as, like, the sweet child mm-hmm. was, like, a reminder, like, yeah, she is the way she is because she was made that way, you know, by circumstance. You know, she started out a sweet, innocent little girl. And, like, that scene where they, like, give her the wine that's, like, supposed mm-hmm. to be safe for children. Like, she's not even a poisoner. And they're, like, giving her stuff that could kill her. And, like, poor thing. Like, she's meant to be a naturalist. And she's, like, thrust into this world of, like, evil poisoners. And they purposely give her to them because she has the weakest gift. I just felt really bad for her.
Yeah. Like, that was a questionable mother move for sure. Totally. It was one thing, like... Especially because she had grown up with the poisoner. So it's not, like, I felt like she didn't even believe what she was saying about, oh, if her gift is weak enough, they'll just, like, leave her alone. Or, like, she knew that that wasn't going to be the case. So it was kind of sad that she took an opportunity. Because what if Catherine had grown up in the naturalist world and, like, how much different would her life have been? And even Arsinoe, yes, the poisoners were bad people or, you know, kind of corrupt, power-hungry people. But if she had a poisoner gift, I don't know, it would have been interesting to see. They both kind of got chipped a little bit, but mostly Catherine.
Totally. And Catherine, like, it would have been cool to see her grow up the way she should have been raised. And it's sad that she had to pay the price.
Well, and I'm so curious if we're ever going to see anything of her actual naturalist gift, unless it was just that moment with the snake that we've seen already. But I'm curious if I guess right now, if she still has the queen power, she has a little bit of every power, which is probably as much as she ever had of anything.
We have to see if she made it through that exorcism.
True. She couldn't have died, right? Says the girl who wants one of the queens to die.
Yeah, right. That's how you win your bet.
But not Catherine. I don't want the bad one to die. I want the good
Poor
one to
Arsenal.
Die.
Poor Arsenal. Just kidding. Okay. What did you think about the Oracle Queen?
I thought it was fun. And I like the way, again, that we took this kind of idea of a legend. So we had heard in the previous trilogy, or the first three books, that, you know, we knew that if you had the sight gift, you were drowned at birth because one of the queens had gone mad and killed three families. And what I thought we were going to find out was that the three families really were mm-hmm. plotting against her. But what we actually found out was that a different set of families was plotting against her, and they killed off their rivals, her friends, and basically framed her for it and locked her up in the tower for the rest of her life.
That was shocking.
And there's a lot more to it than that, but I love that twist. I love that it was like this legend that we had heard about, and it was still, again, true to the legend, but had a lot more going on than you might have expected. And I also love that it gave us kind of another glimpse of how this royalty magic political system is supposed to work, so that we can kind of understand what's different about what's going on right now with Catherine and her sisters.
Oh yeah, completely. I mean, and just to get that whole background with choosing seats for the council and
and finding out how powerful the council truly is, which we kind of have seen glimpses of that through the Aarons or whatever, but really seeing, even though she was queen and she was actually not a bad queen and she did have allies and all this stuff, she was still able to be so manipulated because she wasn't giving the powerful people what they wanted.
This Francesca lady, oh my god.
Yeah.
I mean, and then the whole thing with her, Francesca was sleeping with the king consort to, like, purposely drive Elsabet mad. And, like, she wanted to create that distraction so that she wouldn't see how the Black Council was just completely taking over.
Well, and she was also sleeping with her half-brother or whatever, Gilbert, at one point, at least, maybe not near the end, but it was just, like, so manipulative. And this poor girl thinks her sight gift is failing, and her brother, who she trusts more than anybody, is the one who's been slowly poisoning her.
And he knew it!
Yeah! I thought that was surprising to me, too. I didn't know he would... To be fair, he thought it was like, at least his reasoning wasn't absolutely terrible, but it was still really, really, really bad.
Yeah, and he was just saving himself.
And he never redeemed himself.
No.
Yeah.
Because she was blackmailing him.
Yeah, but I think he did talk himself into, she needs to listen to the council, and if she doesn't have her gift, she will. But it's also like, if her gift is working, then, again, you're safe from war. Like, if you let her gift do its thing, won't she also make good decisions?
Right.
Like, the only reason the council wanted, I mean, the only reason Francesca wanted her gift not to work is because it would have told her that she was the bad guy, probably.
Yeah. And then I really liked that whole thing with Jonathan, that poor painter that just got caught up in the middle.
I know. That poor guy. And then he ended up, his whole family got killed him as well because she had a dream about him and just like, and to be fair, they did form an actual friendship, but it wasn't even, it was so sad. And the story, her friend got shot leaving his house and they like framed this whole story about the crazy jealous queen who saw her friend leaving her lover's house and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no, her husband was the one who was sleeping around and she like wanted to interact with her citizens, not be separated. I don't know. Just like it was just so sad to see her trying so hard to be good and just trusting people too much, basically. And
to have all of the people she trusted framing her, just mm-hmm. killing people left and right and then making her take the blame for everything, gaslighting her, calling her crazy, and then, like, locking her up for the rest of her life and having everyone talk about, oh, the mad queen, the queen who went crazy, and she didn't do anything wrong.
And literally every future generation of the Sight Gift
is drowned now.
Drowned at birth because of this. It's like, crazy. And on top of all that, she still had to meet the king consort and conceive the triplets at some point. And my only question is, did she have to go to the Black Cottage still? Or what happened to her after that? Or
That's a good question. Ew.
But yeah.
That's not pleasant.
It was fascinating, but also incredibly sad.
Yeah. And also, like, I mean, I thought it was kind of interesting, too, that we got to see the king consort, William, and just how completely useless he is. And, like, mm-hmm. I kind of really like the idea of, like, the king consort is really just there to, like, breed twins or breed triplets. And he doesn't really have a purpose. He's not important. He, like,
has no power.
He has no power. Like, I kind of really like how it's just such a matriarchal society. I think that's, like, a really cool twist.
It is, and it's especially interesting because it's only on the island. Yeah. So the king consorts are all coming from the mainland where it's still patriarchal. Mm-hmm. So, like, I do kind of wish we got more insight into one of the king consorts at some point because even the good, like, that's got to be such an interesting shift to go from being, like, so, like, you know, these are, like, the first sons of important people, I think, who are, like, sent on this quest to marry a queen, and then if they win, they're figureheads. At best.
Yeah.
Breeders. Yeah.
Breeders. And like, he was just such a piece of work too. Just like.
Oh, he was the worst. I wish she didn't even like him. Yeah.
How could you? I mean, he's like flirting with women right in front of you.
But she did still like him. I mean, she wanted his attention. You know, it just like, it broke my heart that she like let it get to her even when she knew she shouldn't.
I know. And then he made it sound like she was crazy for like. Getting upset about it. That's what I didn't like either. Like, he wasn't even sorry. He kind of felt like he was doing nothing wrong.
Yeah. Well, because he was being told to,
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just terrible. And again, even, I thought that she was going to uncover the plot and that would be who she killed.
Yeah.
Or I thought something would, again, because we heard the story that she murdered three families for turning on her, I thought that we were at least gonna murder the right people. But then even when she was starting to figure it out, it was just like a step too late, and it was just so sad.
Yeah, it was pretty tragic.
But it also further reiterates this idea that this is kind of a broken system, and you start to understand why like all these angry queens, and you know, the like we've seen it with the Blue Queen too, the fact that like she became the Mist and her sister stepped into the role. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like it's a lot darker than it seemed even at first, which is already pretty dark because it's
sisters killing queens. Each other.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, it's not even like a happy ending at the end of the day. It's like truly kind of a terrible, terrible system.
Yeah. And I mean, just like the whole thing with Rosamund and Sonya, and like one was appointed to the Queen's Guard and the other one was on the council, and they really should have been switched, you know, because mm-hmm. like one has a war gift, and like I really liked seeing the other gifts present. Like, we haven't really met that many people who are like war gifted or sight gifted, so that was mm-hmm. I kind of liked that we got a little bit more of that and got to see how it is like definitely a rare gift but still exists, because like we don't, I guess because the three sisters are a naturalist, a poisoner, and an elemental, like, I forgot that there is, like, a society of war-gifted.
Well, Jules is there now, but they've also gotten so weak, whereas this was, what, 500 years ago
And when they were stronger. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I did think that was pretty cool.
It was interesting, and it made... I'm curious to see if any of this comes into play at all, but it is just, like, a fascinating world that she's built, mm-hmm. so it's been kind of fun to jump around. Although I did have, obviously, still more questions, so if I could ask a lot of things, like, one would be... So I get that she had the sight gift and saw that she won, but I didn't actually hear what she had to do to win. So how did she beat her sisters with the sight gift?
I have no idea.
That was interesting to me. And I also thought it was... cool might be the wrong word, but... Like, she envisioned herself in this completed tower, so she knew this tower was going to be complete, and she thought that was going to be, like, something that was, like, her legacy or whatever, but it ended up being where she was imprisoned.
Her prison, yeah. Which is just another good example of, like, prophecies that you think they might be saying one thing, but they're really not.
On both sides, because even if you're sight-gifted, you don't always know what it's saying. And then on the second side, even, you know, they can say what they want to say or not, I think, so... That's always interesting, too. What do you share?
Yeah. So, yeah, I enjoyed them. They were, like, really fun, easy, fast reads.
Yep.
And it did make me want to really finish the last book. It made me excited to read that.
And again, not that they were perfect or 100% complete or anything, but if I had to pick two stories, this is kind of exactly what I would have wanted. I wanted to know more about the queens beforehand, and I think it was so cool to get not only a previous queen, but this one that we've kind of heard a little bit about and see how this legend played out. Like, I think it's so cool that they picked one that we had heard the rhyme about and knew a little bit of the history for. Between that and the flashbacks to the Blue Queen in the other book, it's kind of cool. Just kind of cool to see. Give more context for the stuff we're hearing about.
And it must have been so fun to write. I always think about that. Because, like, when you have characters and, like, you know the backstory, but, like, you have to decide how much you want to share and, like, how much you want to reveal about them. But I think part of you always is itching to, like, share what you know, right? So I'm sure, like, writing these two novellas was, like, very fun for her. And that's probably why they were so, like, easy and fast to read, because I'm sure it was just, like, I can't wait to share this background that I know that I've not been sharing, and, like, finally I get to have people read it and know what I know.
It's so interesting to me to think about how you write a story and get background for all these characters. Like, does she start with this whole idea of this other queen, and then she, like, brought the legend into the other book? Or did she start with this idea of the legend and then had to flush it out? Or did, you know, like, it's so interesting to me, especially in these things where you go in a forward linear time in real life, you go flashbacky. I'm always curious, like, how much of that was there that you're just revealing, and how much of that are you exploring and trying, you know, how do you get it to fit? And how, like, it's just, it's interesting to me to, like, think about the timeline of writing and getting characters and all the side backstories and how everything fits together. But you're right, it's I mean, at least a portion of this she had to have already figured out or needed to figure out for her own self, and so it was really fun to read, and I'm glad she shared them. And it's fun that they're longer, because most of the short stories we've read, I think, have been...
Too short.
Truly short. Yeah. These were actually, like, novella length. You could dive in.
They had some substance. You know,
start to care about the secondary characters in these books and stuff like that, too, so...
I agree. Did you do any research this week?
I did just a little bit. I looked into portraits.
Ooh! So,
the character Jonathan in The Oracle Queen... asked to paint what's her name's portrait. What was her name again?
Elsabet.
Yeah. Elsabet's portrait during the Midsummer Festival. And even though he was a young and experienced artist, because she had had that dream about him, she, like, accepted. And through the portrait sessions, they, like, became friends and whatnot. And I think we also had a portraiteer in Paint Catherine after she was crowned, right? Yep. So it was kind of interesting to think again about this idea of, I know, like, our presidents do it too, and, like, royal portraits are, like, a big thing. So I was just kind of, I looked a little tiny bit into some stuff around portraiteers or royal portraits.
Ooh, I'm excited.
So I think one of the most interesting things, and probably not truly fascinating, but you may not think about it a lot, was back in the day, there was a lot of prospective couples entering marriage negotiations between different countries back before they had things like photographs and Facebook and whatnot. Mm. So the portraits were a vital tool to basically ensure that the person marrying into your family is sufficiently meets the royal image that you maybe are trying to portray, and or the person agreeing to the marriage may or may not want to marry that person based on how they look, because
yeah,
kings and queens can be shallow people, as can anybody.
Well, that's like Anne of Cleves. Wasn't one of Henry VIII's wife, Anne of Cleves, she like had a portrait done by like a really famous artist, and Henry saw it and was like, yeah, I want her to be my next wife. And then when she arrived, she wasn't as beautiful as her picture, and he divorced her. Did I steal your thunder?
No, I was trying to find that story because I remembered reading something about it, but I can't find it right at this moment. But yeah, I mean, there's all this stuff about people either pursuing people because of their portrait, or refusing them because of their portrait, or marriage contracts falling apart because they don't live up to their portrait, yeah, all kinds of stuff. So, and there, I guess there was a big concern. So they used to ask for basically like a full face image and a full length portrait so that you couldn't hide any disfigurement, would be the idea.
Or so you could see their heights.
Yeah.
No catfishing here.
But you also had to be concerned that the person painting them was often hired by the person themselves and would maybe at a minimum usually exaggerate their actual features, if not outright lie. So in 1795, the future Queen Caroline of England spoke for generations of disappointed royals when she met her fiancé, the Prince of Wales, and said, "I find him very fat and by no means as beautiful as his portrait."
No.
So some artists would... Or some royals, rather, would send their own artists to also capture a likeness of their potential mate to try and get something more accurate. It said almost exclusively the males would resort to this.
Oh boy.
And it would happen as early as the Middle Ages. So in 1384, the French king, Charles VI's advisor, sent an artist to Scotland to create an image of Egidia, the daughter of Robert II, but before the painter arrived, she had already married someone else.
Oh, no.
So then the artist traveled to Bavaria, Austria, and Lorraine, and he saw multiple miniatures that they painted, and the 17-year-old Charles said he fell in love with the 14-year-old Isabella of Bavaria, and they were wed in 1385.
Okay.
Let's see what else.
Have you seen the portrait of Kate Middleton, like her official royal portrait?
No, I haven't.
It's awful.
It's bad.
Look it up. It is terrible. Like, I remember when they unveiled it and I was just like, are you kidding me? Because she's so beautiful and she looks terrible. Like, I don't know how they approved it or like how she didn't just fly into a red hot rage. I mean, she's super classy, so she wouldn't, but I would have been pissed.
I need to look it up right now.
It's so bad. And like, I'm sure as a portraiture, it is a tough job because like you want your client to be happy, but you also want it to look like them. So, like, or how much do you blur the truth a little bit and make them look better than they actually do? Are you looking at it?
Yeah.
It's, like, she looks like her face is made of dough.
Well, it is so funny. So, I was reading some presidential reactions to their portraits, too. So, like, Lyndon B. Johnson, I guess, when he saw his picture, said, "It's the ugliest thing I ever saw," and refused to accept it. And this guy who had painted him, Peter Hurd, was, like, a successful painter already. He like specialized as a portraiture. Like basically he just like told the press about how rude the president was and like didn't care about it. And it was ultimately donated to the portrait gallery, but it was not on display until after Johnson died.
Mm.
And there were just some other, like, so in general, the president's portraits like help shape their legacy. And I think they do get to pick the person who paints it and or like give a little bit of insight, but a lot of them don't see it until it's
done.
Yeah. Where was one? So in Nelson Shank's portrait of Bill Clinton, he painted a shadow of Monica Lewinsky's dress cast onto a nearby fireplace.
What?
And
that's awful.
He like cropped Washington on the background of the fireplace, like he cut off his face. So that, like, the idea was that even Washington didn't want to look on this unseemly man. And so it's just kind of funny to think about, like, all the different, you know, you think about an artist and they actually have so much power to make, like, a statement and a political statement and, like, make an impression and show someone's legacy. And we maybe, like, forget that sometimes if you think of, like, oh, like, artist, creative, do their, you know, live in their own world, whatever. Like, you're thinking a portrait is like an accurate representation, or if anything, a flattering representation. But no, what they paint in the background, or how they choose to display something, or even just if they do it accurately, but like the person is unhappy. Like, it's just interesting to think about all the politics that go into this thing as well. So, again, I didn't read a ton about it because I didn't do a lot of research this time, but I did look at some kind of funny pictures. There's also this, so Alison Jackson has a picture called The Royal Selfie, and it looks like the royal family taking a selfie, but it's actually a bunch of lookalikes. But like on first glance, it does kind of look like the royal family, and it's pretty funny.
Oh, I would love that.
Or there's this one, Mortimer painted a portrait of the Queen in 1997. The artist was 27 at the time and says he wanted to get away from the royal aspect and paint a picture of a person rather than the queen, but it looks like the queen's head is basically separated from her body, so there was this huge uproar about how he, like, decapitated the head and, like, what he's really trying to say, I guess, like, the message really behind it is that, like, the monarchy is crumbling, it's, like, a fractured monarchy, and he... Like, it's just funny to, like, think about all the different interpretations and how mad people get. Oh, there's this other really funny one. So, there's this picture of Prince Philip, and he actually sat for this portrait. The artist was Stuart Pearson Wright, and it's, like, Prince Philip is pointing one finger up, and there's, like, a plant growing out of it, but it looks like he's naked. It's just, like, the chest up, but he's, like, not wearing a shirt.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
So, but Prince Philip, I guess, sat for 4 one-hour sessions and then refused to do any more. And he never took his shirt off for these pictures, but I don't know to what extent he knew that that was the direction that the artist was going to go into, but it's just like this funny picture, and it's like, Prince Philip actually sat for that? I don't know. It's just, if you look at some of these pictures and the stories behind them, and then even some of them, I would just look at them and be like, oh, okay, that's like a fine picture, but then you like read all the commentary, and it's like, oh yeah, that actually is really unflattering, mm-hmm. or oh wow, that is in the background, or you know, it's just, it's kind of crazy how much goes into it. But to your point, and what even is happening in these books, is it is an important thing, especially before photographs, but still it's a tradition today for leadership to have like official portraits done, and mm-hmm. our presidents are displayed publicly too, and like the royal families are displayed. And back in the day, it was even more important because it was the only way people were recognized. So you know, whatever portraits existed of you was the only...
Oof, that was it.
...lasting thing, so...
I had to sit for 2 portraits.
Really?
Yeah, my friend in college, she was an art major, and she did a series of portraits of her friends. But it was really cool because she made all of her friends look old. So she, like, painted portraits of us, but we all were aged and just, like... Huh. She used, like, really interesting colors, and my portrait is terrifying. I mean, it's brilliant. It's great, but it's, like, my eyebrows are out of control. That's, like, the best part.
You have to send me a picture of it.
Oh, I have to find a picture of it. That was, like, over 10 years ago.
We'll see how accurate it is.
And then my cousin, Marco, is an artist, and he did portraits of me, Chad, and my dog, Banjo, for our wedding. I think you've seen them.
Why can't I remember them right now?
You've seen them. They're in my podcast room, actually. I'm looking at them.
I believe I've seen them, but I feel like I would remember that more than I am at the moment. But how long did you sit for these things?
For my friends, I sat for maybe 45 minutes.
Okay.
Maybe an hour. And then for my cousin's one, we just sent photos in. I didn't sit for that one.
Okay. I was going to say, because we have, like, a portrait done of me and my sisters when we were little, but, like, this lady came and took a bunch of photographs of us, and then she painted off of those.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. I did that, too, with my sister, actually.
I do remember Erin, my baby sister, went through that phase that kids sometimes go through, and, like, right before she arrived at our house, Erin cut off a bunch of her hair in the front. Like, you know, like, got scissors, and I don't know, she was, like, 4, I don't know, whatever. And so my mom was, like, freaking out, but again, it was a painting, so she could paint in her hair to look not like
a cut-up moment. But.
And then the only other thing, so our across-the-street neighbor in Belgium was an artist, and I have some of her work in my house, but she did this one really cool painting for my family, and she did, like, paper mache on our faces. So she got, like, it's, like, a 3D painting, and she took... So she got all 5 of our faces, and it's, like, on this cool art piece at my parents' house. So it's not like painted to look like us, but the fact that it's three-dimensionally our faces is like really cool. And especially my dad looks like, we used to joke because it was like hanging over the bar and my dad traveled a lot and it like in the right lighting, you could like pretend like you were talking to him because you like his profile is so distinct. But that was like the longest I've sat for art probably. And I remember being like scared because it like covers your mouth and you're like,
yeah,
like, am I going to be able to breathe or whatever? But it was cool. It's really a cool piece now.
I'm sure. Oh, I want to see that.
Yeah, I'll send you a picture. Cool. Did you do any research?
Yeah, my research is all over the place. I pulled a Katie and I went all over the place.
I approve. I like it. Mine was like, I didn't really go into much depth. I meant to do more, but I got easily distracted this week.
So I started researching facts about triplets.
Okay.
So I'll tell you what I found there. So there's not any scientific evidence that shows that having triplets is influenced by it's not hereditary.
Okay.
So
are triplets, how often are triplets like all three?
Identical.
One, like, can you have, can you have identical triplets or do you often have
you
fraternal triplets or is it a mix or what is?
So you can have identical triplets. That's created when only one egg is released and fertilized, but it splits and then one half splits again.
Okay.
So that's very rare.
Okay.
You can also have fraternal triplets, and that's created when three eggs are released and each egg is fertilized by a different sperm. And that is actually called hyperovulation, and that is influenced by genetics. So if you come from a family where non-identical multiples are common, you do have a greater chance of having twins or triplets yourself.
Okay.
And then you can also have mixed triplets. So that's when you have two identical babies and then one fraternal. So that's when two eggs are released and fertilized separately and one of those fertilized eggs splits. And they say that naturally conceived triplets occur one in every 9,000 births.
Wow. How much more common is twins? Do you know?
Much more common. I don't know. I don't remember the exact numbers, but they said it's much more common than triplets. The heaviest triplets on record were born in 1914. The combined weight of the three babies was 24 pounds.
Ooh.
Yikes.
That's a lot of big babies.
Yeah. There was also a woman from Russia who claimed to have 69 children. So she had 16 pairs of twins, 7 sets of triplets, and 4 sets of quadruplets.
All naturally?
Yeah. This is in 1914.
And she just kept having babies because...
She must have really liked her husband.
I just can't imagine your body going through that.
Wow. No, I don't either.
I guess, and I wonder how many lived to adulthood, because back then, didn't kids die a lot easier?
Oh, yeah.
I would think the smaller, like, I feel like it's harder to have multiple kids because you're born smaller. And
how do you feed 69 kids?
You don't. I don't even know how you feed 2 kids, to be honest, or 1. But
I mean,
I have trouble feeding myself, but oh my goodness.
So then I started researching.
You'd have like a mini army. I'm just like imagining like 6. If they all grew up and like worked on your farm.
Well, what's insane is that by the time your last, I just don't know how.
Wait, how many pregnancies was it?
There were lots of multiples. So.
There were lots of multiples, but what? How many pregnancies was it?
16 plus 7 plus 4.
27?
So 27.
Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm.
She must have been a really healthy lady. Because even if she...
Yeah. And started when she was 13.
Even if she did it like every year, having that many kids. Wow. I guess that'd be till she was 40. But odds are that... I don't know. Wow. Okay, sorry.
So then I went on a path where I was, like, thinking about how every queen that's born with a sight gift is killed.
Mm-hmm.
So then I went down a really dark path of infanticide that I am not going to share with you because I was just like, this got really dark really fast. So instead, I started researching superstitions around births.
Okay.
So, like... We have a lot of superstitions in this book, like, oh, the blue queen is going to have certain powers or whatever.
Yeah,
like
the fourth born triplet, yeah. And even that being conceived in the bell train or whatever is
a good thing. Exactly. Yeah. So I started researching baby superstitions, and some of these are kind of interesting.
Okay.
So in the 19th century, there was a superstition that a newborn baby must always be carried upstairs before it is brought downstairs.
Why?
And that was because you wanted to make sure your newborn was going to be going up in the world. Hmm. So if you had birth upstairs, let's say in your bedroom, and you couldn't take the child upstairs before you took it downstairs, the midwife would hold the baby and stand on a chair and like lift it up and then bring it downstairs.
Okay.
This is interesting. So in Jewish folklore, there was a practice of putting candy under the bed of a new mother. And so that belief was stemmed from the idea that if evil spirits would wander into the room, they'd be attracted to the candy, like the sweets under the bed, and they would leave the baby alone.
Didn't we talk about in one series, I think when we were reading like Winter Song or something, like the changeling thing?
Yep.
What was that again? I forget about that. Because that was also a superstition like, about births, that, like, your baby has been switched, right? It's not your real baby.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that was one superstition where, like, they refused to call a baby cute, or, like, they refused to acknowledge that a baby was beautiful or, like, say nice things about it
because they
would be afraid that fairies would be attracted to it. So, like, in East Asia, people sometimes still give newborn babies really ugly nicknames. And they insult the baby to, like,
protect them.
Make sure evil spirits don't get jealous. Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay, so if a baby is born with a birthmark on its head, that's considered extremely lucky because it means the baby has been kissed by an angel.
Aww.
And if the baby has a birthmark on his or her leg, it's an indication that she or he will be inclined to travel far. Which, I kind of like that one because I have a birthmark on my leg and I love traveling.
I think I have a birthmark on my leg too, actually. And I also like to travel.
There you go.
I also, I think this is actually on a trip with you. Have I told you about the birthmark I keep forgetting about?
Yes.
Like, when we were in, it was one of our 4th of July trips, I think, and I, like, thought there was dirt on my head, and I, like, couldn't get it off, and then I realized it was a birthmark, and I, like, called my mom, and I was like, Mom, did you know I have a birthmark? And she's like, yeah, you called me every few years about it, and I was like, oh, I just keep forgetting about it, I guess. Anyways.
So that's good luck if you have a birthmark on your head.
I don't know what it says about me that I can't remember it, but,
you probably dropped on your head, too. Okay, then I started researching, the superstition of babies who are born with a caul. So have you heard of that?
No, what is that?
So a caul is just, like, a portion of the amniotic sac, and it's when a portion of it still remains on the baby's head. It's actually terrifying if you look up pictures of, like, babies born in a caul. It looks like a baby with its head in a bell jar.
Okay, I don't want to Google that.
Or, like, in a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrifying. But back in the day, it was considered very, very lucky for a baby to be born with a caul. And this is gross. So the caul, like, the actual membrane, was considered to be a really powerful amulet or, like, talisman against evil. And so it was usually preserved and kept in a bag or, like, a locked box for, like, safekeeping.
Mm-hmm. And then what? What would they do with it? Why were they keeping it safe?
They would carry it around for good luck. So, like, in ancient Rome, lawyers believed that carrying a caul in court would help them win their case. It's also rumored that someone with a caul would never drown. So it became, like, really popular for sailors to want to carry a caul, or, like, they'd pay money for one to carry around with them. And it was determined that, or it was believed that infants born with a caul possessed special powers such as second sight, or that they could never be harmed by sorcerers.
Well, that sounds good.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever read The Shining by Stephen King?
No.
No. Okay.
I don't really read Stephen King. Too scary.
Well, their son, Danny, is born with a caul in the book, and he has The Shining, which is, like, second sight. So that was, like, featured in his book. And it's just, like, a belief that if you're born that way, you will rise and do great things. You're destined to be successful.
Is there any, like, dangers with being born that way?
No.
Okay, so it's just, like, if you come out that way, then you're special.
Yeah, I mean, they just have to, like, take it off the baby's face immediately so they can breathe, but...
Okay, but it's not hard to do, or it's not,
no,
like,
no.
Yeah, okay.
So Napoleon was born with a caul. So was Lord Byron, Sigmund Freud, Edna St. Vincent Millay, and Jonas Salk.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's good company.
So, yeah, I know. So, yeah, that was my my research that was a little all over the place, but...
I like it.
I enjoyed reading about the superstitions.
It relates well to how my brain works, obviously, so...
okay. Well, do you want to talk about the next and last book in the series?
Yeah. It came out, it arrived at my house yesterday, but for everyone listening, it's been out for a week or whatever.
I just got it on my Kindle.
It has another number in the title, so that's exciting, but...
Oh, right. So it's called Five Dark Fates. Do you want me to read a little bit about the back?
Yes, please.
Okay. After the battle with Catherine, the rebellion lies in tatters. Jules's Legion curse has been unbound, leaving her out of her mind and unfit to rule. Arsinoe must find a cure, even as the responsibility of stopping the ravaging mist rests heavily on her shoulders, and her shoulders alone. Mirabella has disappeared. Queen Catherine's rule over Fenburn remains intact, for now, but her attack on the rebellion extracted a high price, her beloved Peter. Without him, who can she rely upon when Mirabella arrives, seemingly under a banner of truce? As oldest and youngest circle each other, and Catherine begins to yearn for the closeness that Mirabella and Arsinoe share, the dead queens hiss caution. Mirabella is not to be trusted. In this conclusion to the Three Dark Crowns series, three dark sisters will rise to fight as the secrets of Fenburn's history are laid bare. Allegiances will shift, bonds will be tested, and some broken forever. The fate of the island lies in the hands of its queens.
Interesting.
Oof. There's a lot going on there.
There are so many things going on, but it sounds like we're going to get a lot of answers, hopefully. All the secrets will be laid bare.
But will all of our questions be answered?
Unclear at this point.
Yeah.
It's a good, it's like a size book. It's 450 pages or so.
Oh, good. Okay. We're going to read up to a little over halfway. Our stopping point for next week will be the two prisoners.
Yay. And I'm already wondering who the two prisoners are.
I know.
Guessing it's two queens. Two of the four queens. Or queen wannabes.
Mad Jules. Poor Jules.
Well, to be fair, the backup books can be a little bit misleading. But it does make it sound like her curse is actually unbound and that Peter is actually dead and that the queens are still bugging Catherine.
Still there.
So...
the exorcism didn't work.
We'll see if that's actually true or not. But, and I wonder if I wonder what Mirabella is up to. She gets to be a character again, so good for her.
Yeah, I'm glad that she's not just on the sidelines assisting anymore.
And it is fun now that we have seen that, like, Catherine was the sweet little girl and that they all loved each other. Like, it makes me even more, which I've already said, but want Catherine to be brought into the fold, hopefully.
Yeah, you've always been on her side. You've always been Team Catherine. I've always been Team Arsinoe.
I liked her because she was the first chapter, and I felt like she was, I mean, you know, she just kind of got a bad lot in life, and we find out even more that it was unfairly given to her, and
it did make me sympathize with her much more.
So, we'll see. I wonder what Billy's up to.
Probably at the university.
His dad's dead.
Yeah.
He's still there.
It's hard to keep track of who's alive and who's
dead. Eventually find out. I know, it is
hard. I feel like we've been reading these books for forever.
And we're, like, predicting things. We're like, this person's going to do stuff. And it's like, wait, didn't they die in the last book?
Quadrologies are too long. They're too long, man.
It is. We're getting through it.
We're almost there, though.
If anyone is listening and will get to see Kinder Blake on her book tour, I'm sad because she's not coming near either one of us.
I know. But let us know if you get to see her. I just saw, did I tell you I saw Rainbow Roll?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It was awesome. She was there to promote Pumpkinheads, which was her graphic novel. And she signed my copy of Carry On, which I was, like, super psyched about. And I got to say hi to her. And, of course, I was just, like, giddy and fangirlish and didn't make much sense. And I was just like, hi, Marissa, I have a podcast. I love your books. This book made me laugh so hard. And she was like, okay.
How do we, like, get over that? Because that's how I am with every author I meet. No matter how long I stand in line and, like, talk myself through it, I just, like, can't form sentences. I'm like, oh, my goodness, you wrote a book? You're amazing.
I think my problem is I am, like, hyper aware of how long she has been signing books. Yeah. And, like, me and my friend were the last ones to go. And she just, like, seemed tired, which, like, couldn't blame her. And
I feel that way even in the middle sometimes, yeah, where I'm like, oh, there's all these people behind me and I don't want to like waste their time.
Exactly. So I'm just like, I need to get in and out. Like, I don't want to waste anyone's time. And but I still want to like say something. So it comes out in a garbled mess and I make a fool of myself. But
yeah. How do I say everything I want to say in one sentence and get out of the way and be memorable without bothering them without, yeah, no, there's a lot.
Right, yeah. And take a picture.
Yeah.
But I was glad that she signed my copy of Carry On. And we should totally read that for our podcast because Wayward Son is coming out super soon.
Yeah, that would be good. I haven't read it yet, so let's keep that in mind when it comes out.
Do you want a joke this week?
Nah. I'm just kidding. Yes, please.
I'll pass.
Not today.
So this joke comes from one of our fans, Josh. He sent it in to us. So thanks, Josh. I'm going to share your joke. Okay. What did the drummer name his three daughters?
One, two, three.
So close.
Oh, what is it?
And a one, and a two, and a three.
Oh, I was really close. You were so close. I couldn't think of what drummers actually say at the beginning, but I knew they counted off.
I love it.
But it's funny. I'm glad my dad didn't name us that.
Oh my god.
Good thing he was a nerd instead of a musician.
Thank god for that.
Okay.
All right. If you have any other dad jokes you'd like to send us, you can do so by writing to us at mnktalkya@gmail.com. And we can also be found on Instagram and Facebook.
Let's finish this quadrology. Go pick up the book. Get Tindare Blake to sign it if you live anywhere cooler than where we live.
Yes. And share on Instagram.
Bye, bookworms.
Go get a library card.
M&K Talk YA is produced and edited by Marissa Snyder and Katie Bradford. Original music composition by Timothy Milkey. Logo design by Marissa Snyder. For updates and extras, visit mnktalkya.com or follow us on Instagram and Facebook. And if you haven't already, please rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. We would like to thank James Tobias, Chad Snyder, Meredith Kelfie, and Michael Howard for all of their support. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.